68. Spiridon's Criterion. The treads of the wooden staircase creaked and groaned as feet tramped and shuffled overhead. Now and then, fine dust and scraps of rubbish rained down on them, but Spiridon and Nyerzhin hardly noticed. They sat, clasping their knees, on the unswept floor, in greasy, worn-out blue overalls, their seats stiff with dirt. It was rather uncomfortable sitting like that, leaning back on the sloping boards lining the underside of the stairs. They looked straight ahead, their eyes fixed on the peeling sidewall of the bathroom. Nyerzhin chain-smoked, as he always did when he was trying to work something out, placing his crushed cigarette ends in a row by the rotting baseboard, underlining the triangle of a dirty, whitewashed wall beneath the stairs. Spiridon, like everybody else, received his allowance of white sea canal cigarettes, with a picture on the pack to remind him of the murderous work he had done in that murderous part of the world, which had almost been his grave. But he was a strict non-smoker, obeying the orders of the German doctors who had given him back 3/10 vision in one eye, given him back light. Spiridon had kept his grateful respect for German doctors. When he was blind, beyond hope of recovery, they had driven a long needle into his spine, put ointment in his eyes, kept them bandaged for a long time, then removed the bandages in a half-darkened room and said, "Look!" And the world was lit up again. The dim nightlight seemed to Spiridon like bright sunshine. Spiridon could make out with his one eye the silhouette of his saviour's head, and he bent to kiss his hand. Nyerzhin imagined the Rhenish doctor's tense, preoccupied face softening at that moment, looking at the red-headed savage from the eastern steps, liberated from his bandages, hearing that warm voice choked with gratitude. Perhaps he would be thinking that the savage was meant for better things and was not to blame for being what he was. From the German point of view, his behaviour had been worse than that of a savage. Immediately after the war, Spiridon and his family were living in an American camp for displaced persons. He met a man from his own village, a relative by marriage and a dirty dog, said Spiridon, because of something he had done when they were cobbling together the kolkhoz. Spiridon and he had travelled as far as Slutsk together, but had been separated in Germany. So, of course, they had to celebrate their reunion, and all they had was a bottle of raw alcohol brought along by the in-law. The spirits weren't proofed, and they couldn't read the German label, but it was costing them nothing. Evidently, even the wary Spiridon, whose circumspection had saved him from a thousand dangers, still had his share of his fellow countrymen's reckless fatalism. So, pull the cork, brother. Spiridon knocked back a tumblerful, and his pal downed the rest in one swig. Luckily, Spiridon's sons weren't there, or they would have been given a shot apiece. When he woke up, shortly after midday, Spiridon was alarmed to find the room in darkness so early. He put his head out the window, but there was no more light outside, and he couldn't for the life of him understand why the American staff building across the street and the sentry outside it had no upper halves. He hoped to conceal this disaster from Martha, but by evening he was completely blind. His drinking companion died. After the first operation, the eye doctors told him to take it easy for a year. Then they'd operate again, and he'd recover the sight in his left eye in full and his right eye in part. This was a firm promise. All he had to do was wait. But our lot, the dirty bums, filled our ears with lying tales, told us there were no collective farms anymore, that all was forgiven, our brothers and sisters were expecting us, all the bells were ringing, enough to make you slip out of your American shoes and run home barefoot. This was too much for Nyerzhin. Danilich, he said urgently, as if it were not too late for Spiridon to reconsider. You knew things were never like they said. It was you who talked about planting corn and goosegrass coming up. What on earth possessed you? Surely you didn't believe them. Spiridon laughed, fine wrinkles around his eyes. Who, me? I knew for sure they'd slip the hard collar on me, Gleb, my boy. I was in the lap of luxury with the Americans. I'd never have come back willingly. We know the bait they generally used. Men came back because their families were here, but yours was right there under your wing. Who enticed you back to the Soviet Union? Spiridon sighed.
I said to Marfa Ustinovna, right away. They'll promise us a lake, old girl, but who knows whether they'll let us lap from a stinking puddle. She just ruffled my hair a bit and said, let's just wait till you've got your eyes back, then we'll see. Let's wait for the other operation. But the three kids were so excited, they just couldn't wait. They kept on at us. Daddy, Mama, let's go home, back where we belong. Anybody would think there aren't any eye doctors in Russia. We smashed the Germans, didn't we? Somebody must have looked after the wounded. Our doctors are better than theirs. They said they had to finish school in Russia. My older boy only had two more classes to take when we left. My little girl, Vera, never stopped snivelling and blubbering. Do you want me to marry a German? She kept saying. As if there weren't plenty of Russians for her on the Rhine. But no, the silly girl thought she'd miss her number one suitor if she didn't come back here. They heard me scratching my head. Children, children, I told them. There are doctors in Russia, all right, but life there is murder. Your father's already had one narrow escape. Why are you so desperate to get there? But no, it's only the burned child that fears the fire. So Spiridon had joined the ranks of those destroyed by their children. His moustache, ginger bristles, touched with grey, quivered as he remembered. I didn't believe their leaflets for one second. I knew I would go straight to jail. Still, I thought they'd heap all the blame on me and leave the children out of it. It wasn't their fault. I'd be locked up, but the kids could lead their own lives. Only those scoundrels had their own ideas. They laid hands on the family as well. Men and women had been separated at the frontier and sent on in different trains. Spiridon's family had held together all through the war, but now it fell apart. Nobody asked whether you were from Bryansk or Saratov. His wife and daughter were deported without trial to the Perm Oblast, where his daughter now worked on a power saw in a lumber camp. Spiridon and his sons were whisked behind the wires. The boys, as well as their father, were tried for treason and given 10 years each. Spiridon landed in the camp at Solikamsk with his younger son and was at least able to mother him a bit for the next 2 years. The other son was thrown into one of the remote Kolyma camps. This, then, was home. So much for his daughter's dream suitor and his son's education. What with the ordeal of interrogation and malnutrition in camp, he gave half his daily ration to his son. Spiridon's eyesight did not improve. Indeed, he began to lose the sight of his good left eye. Out there, in the depths of the forest, with all around him snarling and snapping like wolves, asking the doctors to restore his sight would have been almost like asking to be taken alive up to heaven. What passed for a hospital in camp could not have told him whether there was treatment for his eyes to be had in Moscow, still less set about treating them itself. With his head in his hands, Nyozhin puzzled over his enigmatic friend. He could neither look up to this peasant, this victim of events, nor look down on him. He could only sit shoulder to shoulder with him and eye to eye. Their conversations seemed to be compelling Nyozhin more and more insistently to ask one question. The whole pattern of Spiridon's life demanded an answer to that question. The time to ask it seemed to have come. Was the complexity of Spiridon's life, his repeated abandonment of one warring side for the other, simply a matter of self-preservation? Or was it somehow an illustration of Tolstoy's belief that in this world no one is ever right, and no one is ever to blame? That the Gordian knots of history cannot be cut with a presumptuous sword? Perhaps the more or less instinctive actions of this red-headed peasant exemplified the universal philosophical system known as scepticism. The social experiment that Nyozhin had mounted seemed to be yielding that very day, there under the staircase, surprising and brilliant results.
"I'm worried to death, Glib," Spiridon was saying, rubbing his unshaved cheek hard with a gnarled and work-worn hand, as though he were trying to skin it. "It's 4 months since I had a letter from home. I thought you said the snake had a letter for you."
Spiridon looked at him reproachfully. His eyes might be dim, but they were fixed in a meaningless stare like those of a man born blind.
"What good is a letter 4 months late?"
"If you get it tomorrow, bring it along, and I'll read it to you."
"There's no hurry now," Maybe a letter got lost in the mail. Maybe the godfathers have kept you waiting deliberately. Don't worry yourself for nothing, Danilich.
What do you mean, for nothing? My heart's aching for Vera. The poor girl's only 21, and she's there without her father and brother, and her mother's nowhere near.
Nyozhin had seen a photograph of this Vera, taken the previous spring, a big, buxom girl with large, trusting eyes. Her father had brought her safely through a world war. When she was 15, thugs had tried to rape her in the forests around Minsk, and he had saved her with a hand grenade. But what could he do now, from prison?
Nyozhin imagined the dense, perm forest, the power saw chattering away like a machine gun, the hideous roar of tractors hauling logs, the trucks with their rear wheels bogged down and their radiators raised to heaven as if in prayer, the grimy, foul-tempered tractor drivers who had forgotten the difference between obscene words and others, and among them a girl in overall jacket and trousers, provocatively emphasizing her womanly shape. She would be sleeping around the campfire with them. Nobody would pass by without pawing her. No wonder Spiridon's heart ached for her.
Words of comfort would be worse than useless. Try to take his mind off it, and seek in him a counterbalance to your intellectual friends.
Perhaps, Gleb thought, this is when I will learn the fundamentals of homespun peasant skepticism, so that I can base myself on it in the future.
He laid his hand on Spiridon's shoulder, still leaning back against the sloping underside of the stairs, and began hesitantly framing his question.
There's something I've been wanting to ask you for a long time, Spiridon Danilich. Don't misunderstand me. I've heard so much about your ups and downs. You've had a hell of a life, like many others, I suppose. Very many. You've been shoved around from pillar to post, always looking for something that may not exist. But there must have been some point in it. What I mean is, I would like to hear what you think when we try to understand life. What,
he nearly said, criterion.
What yardstick should we use? For example, are there really people on this earth who deliberately set out to do evil things? Who say to themselves, I want to hurt people, to inflict all the pain I can, to make their lives impossible? I don't really think so, do you? That saying of yours about sowing rye and goosegrass coming up. At least it was rye they sowed, or so they thought. It may be that all human beings want to do good or think they're acting for the best, but nobody is infallible. We all make mistakes, and some people are quite brazen about it, which is why they do each other so much harm. They can convince themselves that they're doing good, but the results are bad.
Perhaps he hadn't expressed himself very clearly. Spiridon was looking askance, frowning, as though he suspected a trap.
Suppose you make a glaring mistake, and I want to correct you. I speak to you about it, but you ignore me, gag me, try to shove me in jail. What am I to do? Hit you over the head with a stick? It's all very well if I am right, but suppose I just imagine I am. Suppose it's just a stubborn idea I've gotten into my head. What if I push you off your perch and take your place? And then if things don't go the way I want, it's my turn to pile up corpses. What I mean is, if you can't be sure that you're always right, should you or shouldn't you intervene at all? When we're at war, we always think we're in the right, and the other side thinks they are. Can anybody on this earth possibly make out who's right and who's wrong? Who can tell us that?
Spiridon's frown had disappeared, and he answered as readily as if he'd been asked which guard would be on duty next morning.
I can tell you. Killing wolves is right. Eating people is wrong.
What? What's that, you say?
The simplicity and certainty of Spiridon's answer took Nelson's breath away.
Just that, Spiridon said. The wolf-killer is in the right. The man-eater is not.
Gleb's face felt warm breath from under that moustache. As Spiridon leaned close to whisper,
Gleb, if somebody told me right now there's a plane on the way with an atom bomb on board, do you want it to bury you like a dog here under the stairs? Wipe out your family and a million other people? Only old Daddy Whiskers and their whole setup will be pulled up by the roots so that our people won't have to suffer any more in prison camps and collective farms and logging teams.
Spiridon braced himself, pressing his tensed shoulders against the stairs as though they threatened to collapse on him, with the roof itself and all Moscow to follow.
"Believe me, Gleb, I'd say I can't take it any more. I've run out of patience. And I'd say..."
He looked up at the imaginary bomber.
"I'd say, come on, then! Get on with it! Drop the thing!"
Spiridon's face was contorted with fatigue and suffering. A single tear ran over the reddened rim of each unseeing eye.